This was a bar of the Stumpers, or the Stonemasons bar. It was in Chelsea, that part of London which is very bohemian, and it's a gathering of artists, you know. I had a friend, Oba Hassan, who was a Moor from a country like Algiers or what have you. He was studying in London. I knew all of these people. And he would take me in there to see these folks. And that's where I met Olivier and Diane Dial.
How old were you at this time?
I was about 16 and a half, 17.
Okay.
Valentine Dial, if you see the movie Henry V, the French courtier who greeted the young conqueror, was played by Valentine Dial. It's a beautiful voice. Hassan wanted to meet these people, and also in the last year of the war, it's hard to realize this. As a matter of confidence in victory, the British decided to discharge their artists and actors and great musicians from the armed services to begin working on culture and peace. So the Germans, who still dreamt of victory weapons, you know, in that series, this was very damaging to them. The Brits were thinking of their spies taught them that Henry V, the Valentine Dial, there were these movies to be made. So the Germans began a cultural offensive of their own. And they made a number of movies with French stars. They did not write or censor the script. And two of the movies that they made in their cultural drive, in which they espoused victory, two of the movies that are memorable to us, because they became great classics, was Les Enfants du Paradis, Children of Paradise. I forget the name of the star, this incredible mime, Jean something or other. But this was made under the aegis of the Germans. Still with the war going on, the Germans encouraged the production of La Belle et la Bête, Beauty and the Beast, Beauty and the Beast.
And what was the French word again?
La Belle et la Bête.
La Bête.
Bête. B-E-T-E. Bête.
Okay.
La Belle et la Bête. And he made that. These are really two marvelous movies. When you...
Excuse me. You need to use your microphone.
Oh, microphone. Okay.
Yeah. Let's stop for a minute.
So you had, so in the midst of war, you know, bombings and invasion, you had these people working on projects of peace, you see. The German drive was somewhat make peace in answer to the to this strange cultural war, you see. And, of course, Henry V was a great movie that emerged from this. And people were discharged from the army, or the British dusted off artists who came from suspicious mid-European countries and could only work in war factories. Now they were being dusted off, given canvas and stuff like that. And amongst these people was, of course, a great artist named Kokoschka, you see. Now, with all of, you know, I would explain that the cultural drive, money was assigned to it, and it was a first-class job done in England. They had confidence that, you know, peace will come, and we want to enjoy a good movie. We don't enjoy war movies anymore. And amongst other people, they dusted off Kokoschka and allowed him, they gave him a project, The Magic Flute, which is kind of an opera, which is a coalescence of all things within a nation. It's finest singers, it's marathon type singers, you know, who are normally Wagnerian and stuff like that. And the sets are a great challenge, you see. Artists have tackled that, like in the past decade, this Hockney guy did incredible sets for The Magic Flute.
David Hockney?
Yeah. So all these things going on, that was kind of surreal, you see. You were, an air raid siren would go off and there'd be a flying bomb whizzing through the air. You know, I hated those things. Then the flying bombs were followed by rockets. Each weapon was to be more terrifying to our civilians. But people, oddly enough, accepted the rocket attacks, you see. But I mean, meanwhile, people are looking at theatrical plans and costumes, you see. And there was kind of a rupture in the materials that you needed. So I became indispensable because of my father's ration, mm-hmm. which was still going merrily on to the end of time. So I think Hassan took me there because he wanted me to meet Larry, they called him. He wasn't a sir at that time, they called him Larry. And we all got jobs on in Henry the Fifth as extras, you see.
This would have been a play or a movie?
This was a movie.
A movie, okay.
Yeah. A great movie. Of course, I've seen Kenneth Branagh's, but it doesn't compare to Larry's production. It was just wonderful. So these things were going on. I want to explain that there was never ever hunger in England. You just ate, like potatoes were unrationed. Pork sausages, which is the staple of the British diet, was never rationed in England, you see. We called them affectionately bangers, you see. Mm-hmm. And candy was rationed. Eggs were rationed. One fresh egg a month now. But you can get 4 ounces of powdered egg, you see. Now, when the war ended, the food situation in England got inexorably worse because the shipments that came to us, you see, when we were cut off from Europe, these shipments now went to Holland, France, to the Scandinavian countries. So all at once, there were about 80 million people to be fed. So rationing became even stricter in London. This affected materials. So I was indispensable because of what I could lay my hands on. When I say I assisted with Magic Flute, it's an exaggeration, but what we worked on was I brought him muslins and scrim. Materials you make scrims out of, you know, this theatrical sort of thing where a bunch of figures are playing poker or disemboweling somebody, they light up behind a scrim. I could obtain these materials very handily. What Kokoschka was doing were maquettes, little maquettes of his figures, and the design of costumes for the magic flute. And I was there bringing his stuff, and I thought, my God, this is this guy's incredible. I never had seen any of his paintings. I've never appreciated them at the age of 16, 17, when I kind of encountered this fellow who needed something off of me. And then, but the sketches and his use of colors, there was a book published once of his maquettes, The Magic Flute, somewhere. I don't know who published it. I don't know where I saw it. But the colors, and in wartime England, it's as if it was like an out-of-body experience to fly above it all and do these colors of that opera. I've never seen anything like those marvelous sketches, you see, that man did. He had, of course, many of his paintings were of, would really describe the vortex. Lovers in a Storm is his masterpiece, a masterpiece in so much as it pulls this idea together, and you see two lovers beset by a storm, they're in a cloud, it's as if they're sitting in a flying saucer. That's his masterpiece, and it is. But he had a problem of handling like the axis of a painting, the central mass. He had to be aware of the edge of a painting, because this can offset this composition. Thus he has cities that seem to be floating in space. He did watercolors and paintings of London, and you have the core of the city, and then coming towards you are tumbrils of color that become meandering through raw canvas, you see. Of course, the canvas is employed as a color, you see, but nevertheless, here's this ambient city floating in space. He did these things in London, or was trying to. There were the difficulties of getting canvas. And of course, he did these things in Vienna, where he was from. But it's interesting because in Vienna, there was kind of a senior individual, like a Pissarro, the older painter to the young painters, and people gathered around him. He could solve problems for them, you know, from, you know, a compositional matter to paying your rent, or you're thrown out, then you can sleep on the floor. I mean, a father figure like that. And a father figure in Vienna was Max Brod, who wrote a number of novels.
B-R-O-D?
Yeah. And Max had a young fellow he was taking care of, and that was Franz Kafka, a neurotic little man.
Neurotic?
Yeah. Okay. And he was worried about Franz. He took him under his wing. And then he thought, this guy draws the castle, see? And here's this evanescent castle to which there's no seeming entrance. You know, to enter it and to talk to the people within this edifice seems to be impossible. You know, it's really like what was the metaphor for modern man, you know, dealing with monolithic societies or what have you. And but always there's this thing which, when you read his books, you have the same kind of structure written down. So Brod had the idea that he felt that Kokoschka and Kafka, if only they would meet, would become the fastest of friends and allies. So anyway, he took Kafka up to Kokoschka's studio, and Kokoschka proudly showed him his work, and Kafka said, "What the hell is this? Where are the roads here? You know, this is insane." And they were arguing about this, and Kokoschka threw both of them out, you see. So here are men are doing the same thing, you know, and yet there's no middle ground, it seemed. Sometimes I meet people and they'll talk about paintings, and you seem to agree with them, but when they look at your paintings, you realize that they were talking about something else. They could have written it down, but you're a chasm away from what they're talking about, you know. But this is really crystallized in the matter of Franz Kafka. You read his books, and you see this fellow paintings, you know, in God's name, you know. What disagreement could there be? One had this pictorial vision. The edge of his paintings, he would work so that the edge would support a central composition. Yellow was a color. He dreamt of its use. You see it in the one day I'll get hold of the book of maquettes. I've not seen them in years, I figure. Maybe if I see them again, I figure, what the hell have I been fussing about? You know, these colors are terrible, but I don't think so. I'm going to find that book.
I'll look for it.
Yeah.
Interlibrary loan.
Yeah.
Was it by Kokoschka? Or do you know who the author was?
I think it was a picture of these works. Drawings for the Magic Flute.
Okay.
Anyway, in the sketches, there was an intuitive feeling for the edge of the paper. He would use yellows to correct the composition, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'd use yellow to expand the edge of the painting, the wedge, of the little sketch. So, you know, a sketch or the palette of an artist is always an indication. Emotionally, the palette indicates what the fellow's about, you know.
How do you mean?
I mean that when you squeeze paints onto the palette, there are people who do it in signally different ways. There are people who will go by the primary code, you know, but there are others who do this kind of instinctively. They'll squeeze out the paint that they know they're going to use. And then they'll mix the paint. And then they turn from the palette to the canvas and they paint. But this movement, this simple movement that is accomplished in a second, something happens to the painter. Because when you look here, you see all of the unconscious things that he's doing. You see lyric lines, and yet a lyric line doesn't appear in the work of the man. In others, you'll see, you know, a real drama that's painterly, you see. But you don't see this transference. So this is what people have to do. They are shown their palette, and they're asked why the events that are happening here are not happening on your canvas. Now, what happens to a person? All sorts of things happen. Decades of training or inhibitions or what have you, mm-hmm. Deter that person. And yet, over here they were doing this quite unconsciously, and yet they would arrive at a color, sometimes an emotional color, but something is lost in the transference. It will take years for this thing to overcome this thing, you see. It's either done immediately or it's a huge struggle. Anyway, coming back to Klein, he would
wait a minute, Alfred. You
yeah, he said that with yellow I could do something around the edges, but he couldn't, you see. He would have to watch that core of the painting. If it came towards the edge of the painting, then he'd have to repaint the whole goddamn thing. A millimeter was could screw up work on the painting. So it's his dream that if he could only put a strip of yellow, it would push this whole painting that way, you see, or he can control it that way. Well, but he never had that opportunity. But you'd see it in his sketches, you see. He would, yellow would appear, you know, startling yellows and alizarin crimsons and stuff like that. And the figure seemed to move, you know. I closed my eyes and I pictured them, you know. I'm sure if I see the book, that is what turned me on. But then another thing turned me on, apropos being turned on by something. I went to the British Museum with a class of 9, 10-year-olds, and there was a museum that was set aside for children. You push buttons and illuminate a stage, and it was very interesting. You also see the hanging of one of Britain's most notorious pickpockets, Charlie Peace. This man died in the 19th century, and he's still remembered as someone to be reviled, and came to a sad end, Charlie Peace, you know. It just seems like a figure of innocence, you know, when you recount his deeds. Anyway, when I went there, I got away from the main group of students, and there was a staircase, and at the bottom was they were exhibiting a skull. It was a silver skull. The top of it had been cut away, and in it was jammed this crystalline rock. See, and the rock was a crystal, and when you looked at it, it gave you the feeling of millions of stars. You know, these were aberrations in the schist or what have you. You know, but and I thought, what, you know, I was 9 or 10, I thought, man, that's a brilliant idea. You know, the brain, you know, it's an infinite thing. You know, we have a brain and we are linked to the cosmos. This is what I thought, you know. Well, I went back to England, and when I first went back, I thought, I've got to go and visit the British Museum and look at this thing that turned me on. And I went down there, and it wasn't there. So I retraced my steps, and I thought, this is where the children's gallery is, and it's still going strong. There were kids there with their mothers and fathers, and there was the staircase. And I walked down there again, and then I thought, well, this is maybe a figment of your imagination. But I kept looking, and finally a curator came out of this little office. He wondered if he could help me. I said, yes, there was a wonderful piece of sculpture here, and I led him back to the foot of the staircase. I said, it was silver and there was a rock in it. Where is it? He said, we had to get rid of that because it was phony, said he. He said that someone had made it up, you know, and they had to get rid of it.
It wasn't art.
I said, I still love it. I said, I think it's beautiful. I said that I'd like to see, phony work like that. You know, I was 9 when I saw it. Here I am, I'm 35 or 40, and I still can visualize it. He said, no, that was done by some, it was a fraud that was perpetrated on us, you know, and we had to get rid of it. So that was something that turned me on. Kind of a law in museums that when the new incoming director comes before his board, But people on the board have brought money to the museum, like millions. This is matched by city funds, by state funds and federal funds. No laughing matter. So in New York, Henry McBride had taken up this position as director of the Metropolitan Museum. And he indicated he was going to come back with great treasures for the museum. And he came back with a gigantic Etruscan statue of Etruscan warrior. And he also brought a Van Gogh, which had never been seen before, the size of this panel in the door. And I remember discussing these acquisitions with Maya Shapiro when they arrived. He said, I'm not going up there to look at the Van Gogh. It's a phony. I said, well, you haven't examined it. He said, well, he painted with his right hand, and the copy indicates that he painted with his left. It's a phony painting, you know. He said, but I'll have a look at it. Well, the thing was, the Van Gogh, the Etruscan warrior became where you, if you were dating a girl, you'd meet beneath this behemoth had this minuscule penis. I don't know why people would date and meet beneath this thing. He had paid about $250,000 for this to two shoemakers or cobblers in Sicily who claimed that they had dug it up, you see. They had fabricated the whole thing. Well, the Etruscan...
Excuse me, they had fabricated it? They claimed it was real, but...
They had made it, you see.
Oh, they made it themselves.
But it's something that really wouldn't fool, it would only fool a museum director or, you know, we were in Fiesole, which was where there are so many artifacts that were left to us by these people, and none of them were as horrific as this goddamn thing, you know, the Etruscan. History tells us there were a bunch of aggressive, lazy pigs who'd loaf around, but I don't know how you can do that when you conquer all the world around you. But the figurines, they had such elegance, you see, and this damn thing didn't. Well, they had to keep these artifacts in place for a quarter of a century, and then a minute after midnight, they removed them when McBride left the Metropolitan to go to the Boston Museum.
Even though both were fake?
There were about a dozen fakes that cost the city about $2.5 million. But the problem there is that if they declared them fakes, there would have been a run amongst the trustees. They would not have given money. It's like a panic in a bank.
I know, but everybody knew they were fakes, right?
Well, Marsh Shapiro called them fakes. Bernard Berenson said this is a fake. You know, he was headquartered in Italy, and they were fakes. But we had to live with these goddamn fakes all this time. But eventually they were all removed. The Van Gogh, because it created controversy, was removed. That was removed, you see. But the other things that he brought back. Anyway, that silver skull with that crystalline rock jammed into it was the real thing. I had a chat with the curator. He was interested I'd been to Mexico and wondered if I could bring back artifacts for them, you know. But I said, no, I don't do that sort of thing. They do that sort of thing, but I really don't do that sort of thing. Inadvertently, once I did that, but I don't really do that sort of thing. I leave things where they are. The school I went to, people came up not so much a scholarship for me. You don't need a scholarship to go to, a settlement house. I noticed they have settlement houses in New York. Some of them became quite famous because of the actors who they actually had dormitories in these places where you could sleep, you know, if you were impoverished, but you were doing something. But they all joined in this mob of people saying, you mustn't box anymore, that's ridiculous, and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of...
What's happening?
Difficult for me to go back to that time, you know.
Why?
But, you know, notwithstanding these, you know, aspirations that I had, you know, these a contradictory thing that was physical and mental, you know, with people on one side of the fence and a clamor on the other side of the fence, and definitely superior looking people on the right side of the fence, you know. People insisted that I went to school with the Settlement House also was where Michael Caine did some acting, learned to act. But I said I never met him. I never went to school with him. I don't know him. Lee Montague was a Shakespearean actor who went to the set, who went to that Toynbee Hall when I went there. There were other people, but I don't remember any Michael Caine. But it's a fact that Michael Caine was south of the river and in a gang, and we were pledged to slash him with razors. And I don't like to tell that to people, but it's quite true. So because it's from Southall, we did not talk to these people. They did not talk to us.
So what was
the
name of the book?
Southall. Outhal. Anyway, about 10 years ago, there was a little bulletin we received from New York, and in it there was a telephone number to call Michael Caine and Harold Pinter, because they were having a party, you see. And here I am living up here with my children, and I thought, there's been a truce declared at long last, you know, but because Harold Pinter was from the east end of London, north of the river, and here, and that's all that meant to me. Now, they were up to some sort of cultural skullduggery, or he did Pinter's play with Laurence Olivier, you know, they made a film out of that. The rascals, you know. So I thought, my God, these people get on with one another. And then I saw Michael Caine in a movie about his life, and he was walking down the main street of his borough. It might not be Southall, but it was near Southall. And it's an unmistakable fact that he was describing things that did not jibe with the environment, you see. There was a gay-looking gentleman at a hairdressing shop, with his hand on his hip, watching. There were coach lamps that I'd never seen before. And finally, Michael, who is a movie star, directed movies, checks the lenses, and then he had to say, you know, this was once a dreadful place where we'd fight and blood would flow, but it's kind of hard to believe right now, isn't it, folks? Because here he is in this peasant neighborhood, you see. And I understand exactly how he felt, but he was kind of embarrassed and assured us that this was a battleground during his youth, you see. And that doesn't seem believable either. I remember George Orwell saying that he had insulted working class youth. He said they stank like cattle, and the liberals demanded an explanation of this. He said, well, what's younger or more handsome or healthy than a young soldier, a young British soldier who's been drafted into the army? He says, have you ever walked behind a battalion of these people and how they smell like hell? They don't wear underwear. And it was a fact. We never wore underwear. You see, your pants would become permeated with urine and other defecants, you see. And these people stank. But now, you know, you see little boys running around the gutter in Gucci shoes and Italian cravats, you see. And possibly, you know, they don't have... life has changed.
Okay.
Yep. It'll work. Yeah. Charles Armstrong Lip came from Steamboat Springs in Colorado.
So you're now looking. You know, we didn't start our tape off by saying the date and all that.
Oh hell.
So
yeah, okay.
We could stick it in there now, just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
It's the 24th of May 2000.
It is the 24th of May.
2000.
2000.
Now you're looking at.
I'm looking at the list of names of Hoffman students when I was studying there. Actually, there are a lot of names that I'm really missing, and Virginia was then the wife of Robert De Niro.
Oh, and she was a student.
She was a student. And actually a wonderful artist. She was good, and God only knows why she gave that up. She gave it up, but she was good. Miriam Shapiro, her husband studied there, and I can't think of his name.
That's
name.
Not Meyer Shapiro.
No, Miriam.
Not his wife.
No, okay. It isn't. Meyer Shapiro's wife had a medical practice. She was a doctor, and her surgery was in the same house. Faye Lantzner, Kermit Lantzner was an editor for Newsweek in those days. Also, the criticisms, which were a weekly affair, the criticisms were of oil paintings. During the week you worked in charcoal on paper. And it was understood that when the master approached your work, he could tear it in two or cut it with a knife and what have you, and rearrange it. This was not minded. He would also draw on the work. And sometimes you'd get a very good drawing, all in charcoal with the materials that you had in hand. And these were rolled up as paintings of Hoffman. Anyway, but at the end of every week, there was a criticism of work you were doing at home, of oil paintings. And then it reminds me of a physician in a hospital. I don't know whether they still do. I'm sure they still do. Where he'll gather a bunch of interns will follow the surgeon, and they'll discuss the diagnosis made, and so on and so forth. And this was always the drama at the Hoffman School. And you never knew who would come to the criticism. You'd get reviewers there, critics there, people like Jacqueline Bouvier when she was, before she became the first lady. She also went to the summer school, sneaking out of Hyannis to study with Hoffman. But you'd never know who would be there to listen to criticisms. At school once, I used to cut through this gate on Nickerson Lane and run a diagonal into the barn where we worked, and I had a painting there. And on the path was a lady, and it was Marlene Dietrich, you see, who she had a puzzled look on her face, and I ran into the barn. And they had the entire, all the expatriates from the Ufa German studios there at a garden party. Yeah, this was a German film company that produced all of these films.
Right, spell it.
UFA, Ufa. I don't know what it stands for. It stands for something in German. Filmische, I don't know. And anyway, I was punished for that, so never to enter the garden. again, you see. But some of these people would drift into the criticisms, you see. So
was this in summertime in Georgetown?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you also attend the Hoffman School in Manhattan?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Just before I went there, Joe Haynes was a student there, and we studied together. And her husband was John, and one day her husband drove by the school, and she said, "This is my last day here, and we're heading for Alaska. You want to go?" And indeed, they came to Alaska, and so you'd meet all sorts of people. People who came from all over the place, all over the world, to study there.
How long did you study with
Hoffman? I think I was... You don't really cease studying with him, you know.
But to attend the school, I mean, go to...
I was there for 3 winters. And I think 3 summers. I'd work in the garment industry during the winter and go to night school.
Mm-hmm.
And then the work season would end, and then I'd head for Provincetown.
Where did you, when you lived in Manhattan, while you were going to the school, where did you do your painting?
I lived in a number of places. There were desirable places on Thompson Street called Cold Water Flats.
What did that mean?
I don't know what it meant, because they were steam heated and you get hot water from the faucet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called Cold Water Flats, so I figured that out. And the rents were around $15 or $17 a month.
Did you live alone?
No, I lived invariably with, I shared a place with my cousin. Then the next most desirable things were when the city had condemned a building, when they condemned it, the artists would move in. And that's where I found Robert De Niro once. He lived in a condemned building. And these were the most splendiferous places. Then we all once found, I was very proud of when I found a building that was been condemned. And I convinced de Kooning to move in there, and painters like that. And then there was another condemned building on 2nd Avenue, just across from the Cooper Union, in what they now call the West Village. And however, the building that we occupied was near the Brooklyn Bridge, the one that I discovered near Delancey Street. I went down there looking for kosher food to eat, you know. I had a craving for that and discovered this condemned building. And
how could you live in a condemned building? How could you get away with that?
It's quite easy. If, for instance, the following would be the formula for a condemned building. If it was zoned industrial, you were home free. You can go in there. These were not condemned apartment buildings or slums. These were invariably industrial type buildings, you see, lofts that were condemned. Artists discovered that under the law, the city cannot cut off fuel to these buildings, you see, because this means that people are thrown out of work. So the only thing you had to fear was people who wore these hats with Con Edison on the, who would arrive very dutifully at 8 in the morning and pound on the door. So the first floor was never really occupied because of this incessant banging. And believe it or not, around, if the man was very conscientious, he'd quit banging on the door at noon, you see. And he'd stop doing this, and if you had to do anything or go anywhere or see somebody, you'd leave during his lunch break. Or people who wanted to get into the building would enter during the lunch break, you see, and then would be trapped for the rest of the day.
So you could lock it from the inside?
Yes, oh yes, yeah. Nothing as sophisticated as that. There were huge beams that would, you see.
How about electricity or water?
We got everything. We got electricity and water because these items could not be cut off because of the law, you see. So these are the most desirable places to get into. I remember once on Second Avenue, the people came from the utility company, and there's a little cafeteria on the corner, and when the man would stop banging on the door, he would head for that cafeteria. And we suspect during the morning he would go in there. And at noon, we'd all come piling out. We'd go into the cafeteria, and we'd eat, and we'd watch this fellow. And the minute he started cleaning up, we'd all run back into the building. those were the most desirable buildings.
When you were painting in there, is that right? Living there.
Yeah, living there, painting there, and doing all sorts of things there. And once again, there were people from all over the place. And